If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM, let's create.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Is getting gas at Exxon burning a hole in your wallet? Get the Drop app. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards just by filling up your tank. Download Drop now. Use code DROP66 to instantly receive $5 in points.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Moons once again.
That's right. The Stuff to Blow Your Mind tour of Moons continues. We've over the years, we've previously covered the moons of Saturn, the moons of Jupiter, more recently the moons of Mars, and we intend to move on to the other moons out there, the other lunar systems. But in today's episode, we're going to consider the moons of the two innermost worlds, Mercury and Venus.
I see a flaw in your plan immediately.
Yes, because here's the thing. Mercury and Venus do not have any moons.
Well, that can't stop us, can it?
I mean, we could stop right there. We could just call the episode. But no, we're going to keep going because instead we're going to consider some additional questions and hypotheses associated with these two moonless worlds. Yeah, we're going to look at the question, why are they moonless? Were they always moonless? Did we ever think they might have moons? And so forth. What does this moonless aspect of Mercury and Venus seem to tell us about the neighborhood, the orbital neighborhood more immediately surrounding the sun?
All right. Well, maybe before we get into the specifics of these two planets, we should do a little bit of general moon review, or revision, as the Brits would say.
Yes. So, yes, as a refresher, how does any moon tend to form or arrive or what have you? How do you get a moon established in orbit? Well, as we've discussed in past episodes, there seem to be a few different ways. One of the big ones is the impact hypothesis. Now, this is basically a situation where something large collides with a given planet, knocking debris into orbit and beyond orbit, and the resulting orbital debris forms into a moon.
Yeah, and this seems to be the leading contender to explain the origin of our moon, Earth's moon. And the theory goes something like this. Very early after the Earth formed, so roughly 4.5 billion years ago, it had a collision with another rocky planet, which was a Mars-sized object, hypothetically named Theia. And after this giant crash, most of Earth and Theia, after they crashed together, melted and then reformed together into a new sphere that is now the Earth we live on today. But a small amount of the mass of that crash turned into debris, and that debris coalesced in orbit around the newly formed Earth and became the moon. And the collision hypothesis seems to be consistent with a lot of the available evidence when it comes to Earth and its moon, including analysis of lunar material brought back by the Apollo missions. In fact, I just dug up a NASA press release about new research from 2020, providing further support for the giant impact hypothesis on the basis of different levels of light versus heavy chlorine that are found on the Earth and the moon. So we don't know for sure, but giant impact looks like the best explanation for how we got our moon. But there are other ways for moons to come to exist.
That's right. Another way of looking at it is the hypothesis of co-formation. So basically, the moon forms along with the planet out of the same material that long ago accreted into a planet.
And I think this is often used to explain the likely origin of, say, the moons of Saturn, like the gas giants. So I think also the moons of Jupiter.
Yeah, kind of a garlic knots and crazy bread situation here, where a little dough was left over in the making of the great pizza, and it becomes the moon in this case.
I like the way you think.
Now, the next hypothesis is the capture hypothesis, and this one, of course, is one we talked about a good deal in our Mars episode. The moon, in this case, the moon itself is an object like an asteroid that is captured by the planet's gravity and drawn into orbit.
Right. So, as you say, capture is one of the proposed explanations for the moons of Mars. It fits some characteristics of those moons, but not others. We go into more depth about this in the episodes on Phobos and Deimos. But the short version is, in terms of physical characteristics and composition, the moons of Mars look a lot like asteroids. So that would support the idea that they were originally orbiting the sun. They were part of the asteroid belt. They somehow slipped into what's known as the Hill sphere of Mars, the sort of the area around Mars where an object can fall into a stable orbit around the planet, and then they got stuck there. But there are other things about the moons of Mars, such as their orbital characteristics, which are near circular and near equatorial, that don't really look like capture. Because when an object is captured, originally going on its own trajectory, you'd expect it to have a sort of more elongated elliptical orbit and also to be offset from the equator. So there are outstanding mysteries about the moons of Mars. Their characteristics seem to be a little from column A and a little from column B. And maybe future missions to those moons can tell us something that will help solve that mystery. But there is one moon in the solar system that looks absolutely like it was captured, and that is Neptune's moon Triton. Mm. Now, how would we really know this moon was captured? Well, one very big clue is that it circles Neptune in a retrograde orbit. So it orbits the planet opposite the direction of the planet's rotation. That does not look like something that would naturally happen if, say, a moon co-formed with a planet as an accretion disk.
Yeah, like I said, my main analogy that I made in the Mars episode, it's like cats, you know? If you raise a cat from a kitten, you know, there's going to be, it's maybe going to be a little more orderly situation. But if you have brought a feral cat into your house, it's going to be a bit wilder. The orbit of that cat's going to be wilder. That's the way I like to think of it anyway.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. Now, hopefully in the cat situation, it's not as doomed as the Triton capture situation, one thing I was reading about is how Neptune's gravity is actually sort of dragging on Triton. The fact that Triton is orbiting in retrograde to the rotation of Neptune means the gravity is slowing down the orbit of Triton over time because they're going at cross purposes. And this is making Triton spiral a little bit closer to the planet every time it goes around. And in a few million years, I'm not sure exactly how long, but some number of million years from now, Triton will get close enough to start to get tidally broken up by Neptune's gravity and maybe turn into a ring.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. And then on the cat front, I mean, all cats will eventually explode. That's just science.
Now, these are three of the major explanations for where moons of the solar system come from. You've got, like you say, impacts, co-formation, and capture. But there is actually one more major theory that has been used to explain at least the origins of Earth's moon. I don't know if it's been proposed for any other object in the solar system. But this was the fission hypothesis, the idea that the moon is originally a mass of molten material that somehow was ejected from a rapidly rotating Earth at some point in its early history. This hypothesis, weird trivia, was actually advanced by the astronomer George Howard Darwin, the son of Charles Darwin. Now, I don't think this is a widely held theory at this point. If I recall correctly, it makes some assumptions that are kind of hard to square with other facts. Like, I think it predicts an extremely high original rotation speed for the Earth. But it is at least conceivable in theory, and it does connect to one very eye-popping paper that I came across years ago that has stuck in my mind ever since. Not necessarily because it's very likely to be true, but just because it's a captivating image. And this is an idea that's explored in a paper published in the journal Chemical Geology in 2013 by R.J. DeMeyer et al. And the authors here argue that the fission hypothesis, the idea that the moon was somehow flung out of the Earth or spun out of the Earth, would help explain some of the isotopic similarity between Earth material and moon material. Of course, this would make sense if they originally came from the same ball. But the question is, how does the ejection of the moon actually happen? Like, how do you fling off a moon-sized chunk of a planet? Well, they've got a guess to explain this, and I want to read from their abstract. Quote, "We showed that the dynamics of this scenario requires on the order of 10 to the 29 to 10 to the 30 joules almost instantaneously generated additional energy if the angular momentum of the proto-Earth was similar to that of the Earth-Moon system today. The only known source for this additional energy is nuclear fission. We showed that it is feasible to form the moon through the ejection of terrestrial silicate material triggered by a nuclear explosion at Earth's core mantle boundary, or CMB, causing a shockwave propagating through the Earth." So I'm definitely not convinced it's correct, but that is a memorable take. A naturally forming nuclear georeactor that went supercritical and blew up the planet.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Still, as best I can tell, I think most scientists in the relevant fields would tell you that the giant impact hypothesis is currently the best at explaining the most.
Now, there's another this one's a moon formation hypothesis that's closely related to examples 1 and 2 that we made here. And that is the idea of a ring of debris consolidating into a rough moon. And this is one of the hypotheses concerning the Martian moon Phobos that we discussed. And, you know, while it's not something to jump to with moons, you know, there is also the concept of an advanced civilization establishing an artificial moon in a planet's orbit. Again, that was one briefly held hypothesis regarding Phobos. There's no evidence for this now that concerning Phobos. There's no evidence that an artificial moon exists or has ever existed, but some scientists have considered it as the sort of thing we could someday, you know, look for. We could look for in other systems. You know, it's the kind of thing that we might do in the future if we reach the point where we have that level of scientific power. But again, no artificial moons are known to exist. I don't think any moon in our solar system is currently thought to be artificial in form. But it's one of those things you have to sort of keep on the table, you know, in the towards the back of the table. But it's technically on the table. All right, so let's get to the question then. Why wouldn't any of these various processes result in moons for Mercury or Venus? So first of all, here's some more general stats about moons in our solar system. Our solar system has a current known total of around 214 moons, this is according to NASA, that entails both 158 confirmed moons and 56 provisional moons. And all told, if you go planet by planet in order, you know, from the sun outward, the moon count goes like this. 0, that's Mercury. 0, that's Venus. 1, that's Earth. And then it goes to 2, 79, 82, 27, 14. And those bigger numbers in the middle are, of course, the gas giants. Now, the rest of the moons out there in that 214 total, those are attributed to the dwarf planets Pluto, Eris, Haumea, Makemake, and Ceres, with only Ceres boasting 0 moons. Pluto has 5. Ceres, will remind you, is the largest object in the asteroid belt, but it's quite small. Pluto, which has 5 moons, again, is 14 times the size of Ceres, and Ceres is the smallest recognized dwarf planet.
So Ceres has none, but the larger actual planets of Mercury and Venus also have none.
Yeah, now, yeah, I mean, the reason I'm rolling through all this, I guess, is just to make the point that it's like you can't just look at Mercury and say, okay, well, Mercury is the smallest of the recognized planets, so maybe that's why it doesn't have a moon. Because, again, Pluto, which we don't consider one of the core planets anymore. You know, it has five moons, but it's smaller than Mercury. Right. So, you know, something else other than just the absolute mass of the world is in play here.
Now, there is something that Mercury and Venus have in common, which even without knowing much about how the solar system was formed, you could probably just guess is a major reason that they don't have moons, and it's that they are the closest to the sun.
Yeah, and this basically relates to the short form, simple answer to this question. This is the answer that you'll find across NASA's web presence, especially in various short form and QA articles. Yeah, they're just simply too close to the sun. If a moon were to orbit one of these worlds, there would be two major risks in play. If we were to venture too far from the planet it's orbiting, it would venture into an unstable orbit and the sun would capture it. And if it was too close to the planet, they'd be destroyed by tidal gravitational forces. And while there is a stable orbital zone around these planets that could remain viable for billions of years, it's likely so narrow that nothing has ever been captured by it or created within that stable zone.
Yes, and so this does apply to some extent to both of these planets, but especially to Mercury. It would be really hard for Mercury to have a moon, and it looks like it would be somewhat difficult for Venus to have a moon, though not as difficult as for Mercury.
Right, right. So, you know, we don't know for certain. We know there are no moons orbiting either world now, but scientists have wondered if there have been moons in times past. So we'll get into some of these questions as we go planet by planet. Now, brief throwback to a past episode. There's the hypothetical planet Vulcan that was once thought to exist between Mercury and the sun. And we actually call such hypothetical bodies, especially asteroids between Mercury and the sun, Vulcanoids. Now, Vulcan was proposed by French mathematician Urbain Le Verrier during the 19th century to account for irregularities in Mercury's orbit that are now explained by general relativity. But occasionally you'll see some, you know, people talking about the possibility of Vulcanoids. No evidence of a Vulcanoid has ever been reported. Granted, it's difficult to observe things that close to the sun. But it's interesting because we've discussed the shadowy world of potential mysteries in the trans-Plutonian outer reaches of the solar system. But it's also interesting how the bright inner realm of the solar system can also be shrouded in mysteries.
Yeah, and this is one of the major themes we talked about in that previous episode. If you want to go look that up, it might have been a two-parter, I don't recall, but it was called The Lost Daughters of Aten, where we talked about multiple hypothetical planets or other planets that were believed to exist at one time or another and were later discovered not to exist. And it was cool, yeah, the idea of Vulcan, an inner planet that would explain the precession of Mercury's orbit, was in fact done away with by not by an observation, but by a new theory, which, as you say, was general relativity.
But it makes me wonder if we still have kind of a geocentric impulse in our understanding of the solar system. Like, we know the Earth is not the center of the universe. We know our sun is not the center of the universe. We know our planet orbits the sun. And yet we think about our sun. We kind of think of that as like the center of things. Like, and therefore it should be the center of knowledge. It should be the bright inner part of the city that we know the most about. And yeah, the outskirts are dark and mysterious, but surely the inner area, the place right next to the light, we shouldn't have any mysteries or outstanding questions about that. But we do, because we don't live there. We live, we're more in the suburbs. The Goldilocks suburbs.
Yeah. I mean, another way you could think about it is when we're looking for stuff way out in the dark, that's the problem, is too little signal. When we're looking for things really close to the sun, there's too much noise.
Yeah. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code. A lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
You know, everybody has their own wellness routine, their own approach to a healthy lifestyle. A lot of the most successful ones include herbs like ginger root, ashwagandha, and so many others. Nature's Way has been sourcing herbs like those for over 50 years. They understand that nature is the ultimate problem solver, so they're dedicated to providing plant-powered formulas to help people live healthier lives. Their herbs can support your health in so many ways. For instance, ginger root and slippery elm bark have both been used for centuries all over the world. Ginger root has traditionally been used to soothe occasional digestive upset, and slippery elm bark to soothe the GI tract. St. John's wort, holy basil, and ashwagandha can provide mood and stress support, which is something we can all use in our modern life. I mean, these herbs come from all over the world, but Nature's Way knows where the best ones grow. They test for potency in their state-of-the-art lab, and their scientists are experts in all things herbs. What's on the label is what's in your bottle, and what's in your bottle are the best herbs around. To learn more, visit naturesway.com.
All right, well, let's talk some more about Mercury here. So, again, Mercury has no moons, and this knowledge is based on observation, number crunching, and two previous missions to Mercury. Mariner 10, which launched in 1973, which conducted one flyby of Venus and three flybys of Mercury, and the other is MESSENGER, launched in 2004, which did two Venus flybys, three Mercury flybys, and an orbital insertion, achieving a quote-unquote perfect orbit before it ran out of fuel for alterations, and its orbit decayed, and in 2014 it crashed into Mercury's surface.
So it didn't see any moons.
Correct. No moons were observed. And I don't think there are any serious scientific arguments for the existence of a Mercurian moon today. But this hasn't always been the case. So I thought we might go back in time to 1974. And before we get into this, I need to drive home something I've probably said before and related before, and that is that I do not like April Fool's Day.
It's abominable. It should be illegal. I regret every time I've done an April Fool's Day thing in the past. I resent everybody who does April Fool's Day things today, especially given I just earlier this morning was reading about an article in a respectable, but I'm not going to name names, but an article in a respectable publication that in a hugely embarrassing mistake extensively referred to as a source an April Fool's Day article, an interview with an author that didn't actually take place and was posted originally as an April Fool's hoax. And I live in constant fear that this is going to happen to me, that I'm just not going to notice that something was an April Fool's joke and I'll think it was real and refer to it on this show and just die.
Yeah, it's a celebration of low-hanging fruit and cheap gotcha humor, and it's often used by reputable people and sources engage in it, and yeah, it makes it confusing later on when you're like going back through the archives of something and then you're like, wait, all right, this is April 1st, this is the day before, the day after April 1st, and you know, it's if we're going to celebrate April Fool's Day, we can't we can't like not do other news on that day. You know, that's ridiculous. So anyway, we mentioned all this because the incident that we're discussing in 1974, it was covered in the New York Times on April 1st, 1974. But this is a legitimate news article by Walter Sullivan and not an April Fool's Day joke. But really, part of me wishes they could have just held onto this one and published it on April 2nd. And this was confounded by the—I mean, our confusion was confounded anyway, when you found an actual April Fool's Day joke by—was this by NASA that came out many years later?
Yeah. I think this was posted on April Fool's Day 2012. It's now labeled April Fool's Day. I don't know if it was at the time. And it was the announcement of a discovery of a moon of Mercury.
Yes. Imagine our confusion.
Yeah. So I think it was posted maybe as NASA's astronomy picture of the day that they do. Mm-hmm. And it's called Mooning Mercury. Teehee. And it says that there's a moon that is approximately 70 meters or 230 feet in diameter that orbits Mercury at a mean distance of 14,300 kilometers. The proposed name for the moon is Caduceus, named after the staff that's carried by the Roman god Mercury. And this, it reads like a real piece of NASA copy. You know, it's not just like an obvious wet joke. So imagine my irritation in reading about this and then trying to figure out if this is somehow related to the April 1st news article you're talking about from decades previous.
Yeah, because the link you shared here for this, aside from the tag April Fool's Day, there's no punchline in this, or at least none that resonates with me or certainly the casual reader.
Yeah.
Like there needs to be some. In my opinion, you need to get to that like ridiculous point where it's clear that they're messing with us. But at any rate, yes. So I did a little research on this just to be sure, because it made me nervous as well. According to David Dickinson in Universe Today, in the article Astronomical Pranks of April Fool's Past, Dickinson writes that, quote, spurious moons are apparently the low-hanging fruit of astronomical April Fool's pranks. And so he mentions this one specifically, but does point out that there was indeed, a 2012 April Fool's Day joke about Mercury having a moon, but that the 1974 confusion and subsequent press coverage of it was legitimate. So,
okay.
Again, maybe we're making too big a deal out of this, but I want to be clear, like this is not an April Fool's joke, the 1974 publication here.
Okay, so the 74 article was about something that they thought had been discovered perhaps by the Mariner 10?
Yes, and I'm going to read from part of it here.
Okay.
Pasadena, California, March 31st. That's refreshing that it's actually tagged the day before. Quote, an ultraviolet scanner aboard the Mariner 10 spacecraft has detected what seems to be a small moon in orbit around Mercury. It would be the first moon discovered orbiting either Venus or Mercury, the two planets between the Sun and the orbit of Earth. Then it goes on for a bit. It comes back. Mariner 10 flew by Mercury Friday for the first close-up reconnaissance of that planet. The mysterious object that may be in orbit around Mercury was reported by Dr. Lyle Broadfoot of Kitt Peak National Observatory in Arizona and Dr. Michael McElroy of Harvard University. From the observations so far, it appears to be moving at about 10,000 miles an hour relative to the planet in rather eccentric or egg-shaped orbit, roughly 15,000 miles above Mercury's surface and more or less in the planet's equatorial plane. It is thought to be far enough from Mercury to be spared destruction from stresses induced by the planet's gravity. However, as noted by Dr. Bruce C. Murray of the California Institute of Technology, the head of the picture interpreting team, any moon of Mercury would be subject to a, quote, tidal tug of war between that planet and the Sun.
All right, so it seems like some of the same concerns we've already talked about are being stressed as possible reasons to be skeptical of this discovery at the time, and it would turn out that this discovery at the time was a false one.
Right, and I should also point out the article, which you can read in full in the New York Times archives. It goes on to speculate that this might be an asteroid captured by the planet's gravity, but then also goes on to just talk about a number of other interesting additional findings that were coming in from the Mariner 10 spacecraft at that point. But, yeah, looking at it, especially, you know, with knowing what we know now, so this is what occurred. The details of this seem to be that one of Mariner 10's instruments registered a bright UV emission, what we would call now a far UV, that seemed out of place. Then it was gone the next day. Then 3 days later, it was back and seemed to be coming from an object that, as Swedish astronomy author Paul Schleiter explains in Hypothetical Planets, quote, seemingly detached itself from Mercury. So one idea was, well, that maybe we're looking at a star. You know, we're just watching, you know, we're seeing the light of a star as the planet is moving between us and the light of that star. But then it was observed that the emissions were in two directions, and they thought, well, maybe it's a great deal closer to us, like something orbiting Mercury. But subsequent data indicated that it was not, in fact, something orbiting Mercury. It was not a moon. It seemed to move, then it seemed to move beyond Mercury, and then it was determined that this actually, was not a moon, was not something orbiting Mercury. It was bright UV light stemming from the binary star system 31 Crateris, located 3,166.63 light years away from Earth. But this finding itself ended up proving very useful because it was the realization that extreme UV could travel this well across interstellar space.
Oh, interesting. So despite what you may have read, April Fool's Day or otherwise, Mercury has no moon. It's probably not ever going to have a moon. This is not a happy place for moons to live.
Right. But for a brief moment there, it apparently seemed possible. But it seemed possible because there was... because of the information we were receiving, and we didn't know quite how to analyze it and how to understand it, but then subsequently we did. And this is not the only example of far UV. There are other examples that have subsequently been detected. So this alone is not an anomaly.
Right. Well, are you ready to talk about the planet Venus?
Let's do it.
So Venus is, as we said earlier, another planet without a moon, though it wouldn't be as surprising to find a moon orbiting Venus as it would be to find one orbiting Mercury. Observation of Venus through a telescope actually has a very interesting history with a lot of cool controversies and mysteries in it. One example that we've talked about on the show before, I know, is that the observation of Venus was one of the lines of evidence offered by Galileo in support of the heliocentric model of the solar system. Now, there were a number of arguments he offered. One was based on observations of the surface of the moon through a telescope. You know, when you look at mm-hmm. the surface of the moon, it appears cratered and to have terrain, going against the idea that these objects in the heavens are just sort of like perfectly smooth, ideal bodies. Instead, it looks like the moon is made of rock, much like the Earth is. And then the other things were he saw the Galilean moons named for him of Jupiter. And so the observation that there could be things orbiting another planet like Jupiter made it seem like, well, then maybe not everything orbits the Earth. Maybe just things orbit other things. And so it seems more plausible that the Earth could be orbiting the sun. But then also one of the lines of evidence he produced had to do with the observation of the phases of Venus. Of course, Venus, from our perspective, has phases just like our moon. And the question is, why? Why does our moon have phases to begin with? Well, the moon is full when it's on the opposite side of the Earth from the sun, allowing sunlight to reflect off of the full disk back in our direction. So the phases of a spherical object that we see in the sky are determined by our viewing angle of the day side of that object. You know, the sun is always shining on half of that sphere. What is our viewing angle on the brightly lit half? And Galileo observed that Venus also went through phases like this that would be consistent with it orbiting the sun rather than the Earth. For example, appearing more as a half disk when it's further away from the sun, but growing full when it neared alignment with the sun. So if you try to picture that, when Venus is on the opposite side of the sun from us, roughly, we're going to get the best view of its full day side. But another one we've talked about before was the interesting issue of the ashen light. Do you remember this one?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So this is a supposed faint glow emanating from the shaded regions of the surface of Venus, which has been observed or at least claimed by a bunch of astronomers over the years. You can go back and listen to our full episode on that if you want to know more. But the planet Venus has also been subject to spurious satellite sightings. And I figured we should talk about a few. So one of the Venusian moon sightings, and this is probably the first ever, was by a 17th century Neapolitan astronomer named Francesco Fontana. And Rob, I've attached a picture for you to look at of this guy. I don't know how accurate this drawing of him is. Actually, it's an engraving from the 17th century, I guess. Or actually, I'm not sure when this was produced. But in this picture, he looks like he's up to no good. He looks like he's thinking about, I don't know, going through your trash or something.
Yeah, he looks kind of like a like a Cabbage Patch doll a little bit, like a a slightly sinister Cabbage Patch doll with a mustache and goatee.
Fontana was actually originally a lawyer by training. He studied law at the University of Naples, but apparently at some point his interests shifted and he became more interested in the study of mathematics and astronomy. And so Fontana actually became one of the early telescope makers of the telescope revolution. Now, another thing you'll recall that we've talked about before, I think this was actually in an invention episode we did on the telescope. It's difficult to say really with confidence who should get credit for inventing the telescope, because you can make arguments, you know, like what really counts as the invention and when did they first have it? You know, was it Galileo? Was it Lippershey? Something was sort of in the air in the early 1600s, and a lot of people were experimenting with lenses and magnification in this first decade of the 1600s. Galileo's famous initial observations were in 1609, but Francesco Fontana was part of this movement also. He was making telescopes right around the same time. And according to the Danish historian of science Helge Krag in his book The Moon That Wasn't, Fontana was one of the most respected early telescope makers in Italy, and he achieved high levels of magnification at the time by pairing together two convex ocular lenses in alignment. But this reputation for making high magnification telescopes did not necessarily translate into a reputation for being a good astronomer or being a good scientist. But try he did. Krag writes that by using a telescope of his own design, Fontana was able to produce the first known drawings of Mars in the 1630s, though unfortunately, his drawings appear to be based mostly on optical illusions rather than genuine surface detail. And so to read from Krag here, quote, "In observations of 1636 and 1638, Fontana saw in the middle of Mars, quote, a black cone like a very dark little globule. But he was uncertain, quote, whether it was separate from the planet itself and a satellite of it, or rather a big hollow on its disk." So so here's a good pitch for you, right? The black cone of Mars.
Mm. Yeah, this is, you know, we've discussed this phase of the telescope and looking for things and how, you know, ultimately we have to remind ourselves, yeah, this wasn't a situation where you're taking a photograph, getting some sort of like a high... you know, high detail, you know, objective imagery. You know, there's it's a human observing something, and so all the various optical illusions and illusions of perception that are there, just, you know, in our everyday life, are also present through the telescope.
Right. So for the first few hundred years of astronomy, there are a lot of cases where somebody says they saw something and somebody else looks for it and they can't see it. And then they just argue back and forth and other people chime in. Yeah, I saw it. No, I didn't see it. I don't think it's there.
Yeah. So there's a lot that can go on there. You know, you can just be straining to see something and think you see something and then reinforce that idea that you saw something. You may be picking up on some sort of momentary, illusion that is, due to the physical structure of the eye, something to do with the lenses, perhaps. Not to mention you get into atmospheric phenomena as well. Like, there's so many things that could interfere with it.
Yeah, totally. And a minute ago, I should add, just to clarify, I think I said the first few hundred years of astronomy. I mean the first few hundred years of telescope astronomy. Yeah. Obviously, people have been doing naked eye astronomy for a long, long time. But so, yeah, so Fontana was, as we say, a respected telescope maker, but his astronomical observations were not similarly respected by his peers. In fact, this book I'm talking about by Helge Krag just catalogs a bunch of people talking trash about Fontana. A lot of them are like, this guy is not smart. He is not good. And Galileo was apparently somewhat contemptuous of anything Fontana reported seeing. Sort of like, yeah, he makes pretty good telescopes, or at least high magnification telescopes. I'll give him that. But don't believe him if he says he saw something. That was essentially Galileo's attitude. And there's a great quote in this book where Galileo's assistant, Evangelista Torricelli, was writing a letter in 1647, and he was writing about Fontana's observations. He writes, quote, "I have the book of foolishness observed, or rather dreamed, by Fontana in the heavens. If you want to see insane things, that is, absurdities, fictions, effronteries, and a thousand similar outrages, I will send you the book."
Oh, man, what a pull quote.
Yeah. Yeah, they should print that on the back. Yeah. But in the 1640s, Fontana made observations of Venus, and it looks like here he also got a lot of things incorrect. So, for example, one thing he thought he saw was, so when you're looking at Venus, he is seeing the phase of Venus, right? So it's partially illuminated. And he thought, based on the partially illuminated circle that he was seeing, that Venus must actually not be spherical, but more of an oval shape. The way he drew it makes it look like it's sort of elongated from pole to pole, which I guess a lot of planets actually are, but not to the point that you would see it as an oval like this. This is definitely exaggerated.
This looks like more like a lima bean or something.
Yeah.
Or maybe just a straight up bean. It looks like a great bean in the sky.
Yes, it is very bean or almost banana-like. Though, to be fair to him, he's drawing, I guess, the illuminated portion of it, but still, it's stretched out. He also drew fringes around the planet. Krog writes that this is not something that's actually there. This is an optical effect. But here is where we get to the moon or moon-like observation. So here to read from Krog. Krog writes, quote, "On the evening of 11 November 1645, Fontana observed near the center of Venus, of the Venus crescent, quote, a certain spot of subdued reddish color, noting that this was, quote, a new discovery hitherto unknown. He did not report the size of the spot, but from his drawing it appears that it had a radius of about one-fifth of that of Venus. The Neapolitan telescope maker further reported," and this is a block quote from Fontana himself, in translation, obviously, "two small dots were seen to accompany Venus, which I would suppose to be her courtiers and attendants, as we shall also call those of Jupiter and Saturn. This is a new discovery, not yet published, in my opinion, but it is true that they do not always appear, but only when Venus is shimmering, as will be revealed in the diagrams, and these little dots were always seen to be of a more reddish color. These little dots were, however, not always seen in the same situation on Venus, but they moved back and forth like fish in the sea. From this it can be deduced that Venus itself moves in the same way and is not attached to any part of the sky." Okay, so moving around like little fish in the sea, he sees at least one dot, maybe sometimes multiple dots, though it might be notable that he only notices it when Venus is shimmering. Now, Fontana's claims, he went on to say that he saw the globes or the globe. I think at one point he sort of resolved it to say, well, maybe there's just one of them. But he claimed to see them on multiple subsequent occasions, and his claimed observations immediately caught people's attention. A number of other astronomers expressed skepticism about Fontana's claims, though, and reported having independently searched for these moons and found nothing. So I just wanted to mention a couple of examples of his contemporaries who were not impressed by these claims. One was an anti-Copernican astronomer named Giambattista Riccioli. A couple of notes on him. Number one, I think this was actually the guy who was the first observer or one of the early observers of the so-called ashen light on Venus. But if he's an anti-Copernican astronomer, I think that means he is holding out for geocentrism, which is cool. But he described Fontana's observation of a possible moon of Venus. To be fair, I don't think Fontana said it was a moon or said he was certain it was a moon. He just saw a dot, whatever this globule was. And so Riccioli, he called this observation very ungraceful, which I thought was really funny. It's like, you know, oh, you saw a moon of Venus? Gross, dude. So Krog quotes Riccioli in his writings on this, and Riccioli says that, you know, whatever it was Fontana was looking at was, quote, either something like a meteor or a little cloud in the evening or something like sunspots in front of Venus or the lunar image of a cave and of mountains. And then he added, quote, I have never, and neither has Francesco Maria Grimaldi nor Pierre Gassendi, other astronomers of the time, as seen in book 3 of his Institutionis Astronomicae, admitted ever to have observed at Venus or close to Venus any globules in any telescope. So no globules. And I almost feel kind of bad for Fontana, because it seems like of all his contemporaries, it's like nobody likes him. He's got heliocentrists and geocentrists both insulting him constantly. I don't know, maybe the selection of quotations that I've come across in this book are especially bad. Maybe people were saying nice things about him elsewhere. But he would definitely not be the last to believe that he had seen a moon or some other kind of object near Venus, because here we're going to get to a much more celebrated and well-remembered astronomer, Giovanni Domenico Cassini, who mm-hmm. also saw the moon that supposedly didn't exist, though I think he also never said it was a moon. Cassini lived 1625 to 1712, and he was an Italo-French astronomer and mathematician who was known for having discovered multiple moons of Saturn. The Cassini space probe, which visited those moons of Saturn, was named after him. And Cassini believed that he observed a small object in orbit around Venus or near Venus multiple times, once in 1672 and then again in 1686. He thought that the object was about one quarter the diameter of Venus, and he says he observed it in one case for about 15 minutes and then lost track of it. But then he has in one of his writings, he has a full description of his observations, and this is from the observation on January 25th, 1672. He says, quote, Venus was then horned, and this object, which was of diameter almost one quarter that of Venus, was of the same shape. It was distant from the southern horn of Venus, a diameter of Venus on the western side. In these two observations, I was in doubt whether it was or was not a satellite of Venus, of such a consistence as not to be very well fitted to reflect the light of the sun, and which in magnitude bore nearly the same proportion to Venus as the moon does to Earth, being at the same distance from the sun and Earth as was Venus, the phases of which it resembled. But in spite of some research I have done from time to time after these two observations, in order to complete a discovery of such great importance, I have never succeeded to see it except these two times, and this is why I suspend my judgment." So Cassini's holding off a little more. He says, I thought I saw something a couple of times separated by many years, but I'm going to reserve judgment because I'm not sure what I saw, if I saw anything, and I'm not sure it was a moon if I did see it. But in the decades that followed this, many other astronomers, I think probably dozens based on what I was reading, at some point claimed to see a satellite or companion to Venus. But then many others looked for it and failed. And of course, the observations of a moon of Venus were all wrong. We know now Venus has no moon. A number of reasons for these faulty observations have been advanced as possible explanations, many involving optical illusions caused by problems with telescope lenses or interference between the telescope lens and the eye, as well as the mistaken observation of stars in the background for objects in the foreground. But there is one interesting variation on explaining these observations that was put forward by a Belgian astronomer named Jean-Charles Houzeau, who was once a director of the Royal Observatory in Brussels. Houzeau tried to square the circle of all these conflicting observations by suggesting that the object being observed was not a moon of Venus, but another planet, which often appeared near Venus, often appeared in conjunction with it at certain times of year when their orbits lined up. And this also proved to be incorrect, but it's a very interesting idea. And he gave the hypothetical planet a very cool name, Neith.
Yes, Neith. Neith is interesting because this is the name of an Egyptian goddess. So I had to look. Neith up in the book on Egyptian mythology by Geraldine Pinch that I've really enjoyed this year. And Pinch describes Nithe as, quote, a formidable creator goddess who could be called the Great Mother. And the name literally means the terrifying one, an imposing goddess who wore the red crown of the North and whose curious symbol may have originally represented the click beetle. Click beetle is found near water, so there would be a link to the Nile in inundation. We talked about that in a previous episode and its importance in Egyptian mythology. But the same symbol was later interpreted to be two arrows crossing a shield. She can be considered the mother of both Ra and Horus, but also sometimes Sobek as well. She is goddess of all things linked to the, quote, fertile primeval waters. She's the mother of snakes and the mother of crocodiles, creatures, quote, who are in the abyss. She is sometimes depicted as a crocodile-headed goddess nursing young crocodiles. And Sobek is, of course, linked to crocodiles as well. And when she spat into the abyss, the chaos god Apophis is said to have been born. And so she's also the mistress of the bow, which she uses to shoot down the enemies of Ra, as well as the offspring of the chaotic Apophis, who is, at least in some accounts, her own offspring. So anyway, really cool goddess to draw your name from in coming up with potential names for hypothetical planets.
Oh, yeah. I'm all in favor of more Egyptian naming of celestial objects. I mean, you obviously we love Greek and Roman mythology, but you know, there's plenty of Greek and Roman mythology already in the heavens. Get Egyptian mythology more up in there, and all the mythologies.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing it to a certain extent. I feel like we keep drawing names from other cultures and other deities and other pantheons. And certainly there's no shortage of things out there to give fancy names to. So we'll probably run out of gods and goddesses first. Eventually we'll reach, you know, the point in our culture's future where we're having to name stars stuff like Gozer. We'll have to draw on fictional pantheons.
Very good. Though I kind of dread the day we get like asteroid R'hllor, the Lord of Light.
Probiotics aren't a trend anymore. They're a mainstay in the health and wellness aisle of your favorite store. And Nature's Way Women's Probiotic Pearls are the easiest way to introduce a probiotic into your routine. I mean, they're just what they sound like. Adorable little pearls that couldn't be easier to take. But they still pack that probiotic punch. Each tiny pearl has 1 billion active cultures and protect against occasional bloating, constipation, and digestive discomfort. And they actually support both digestive and vaginal health, so that's a win-win. And according to my little fact sheet here, they're designed with a triple layer coating that protects each pearl from stomach acid, so they can make it all the way to your small intestine where they're needed most. You probably didn't think we'd be talking about the small intestine today, did you? Well, digestive health is kind of important. If you know, you know. To learn more about Nature's Way Women's Probiotic Pearls and how they can fit into your routine, visit naturesway.com.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Now, there's one more thing I wanted to mention about Venus, which is an idea I came across in an astronomy paper from 2006. I'm not sure how well this has held up in the years since, but it's a suggestion that Venus could have possibly had a moon or even multiple moons in the past. And it also connects to an interesting fact about Venus, which concerns its rotation. The rotation of Venus is unusual. First of all, it's very slow. In fact, it's so slow that on Venus, a day is actually longer than a year. So the planet goes all the way around the sun before it completes a single full rotation. And the second fact is that its rotation goes in the opposite direction from most of the other planets. So the standard rotation orientation in our solar system is counterclockwise from the North Pole, but Venus spins clockwise at this creeping pace. So what would these facts potentially have to do with a hypothetical moon of Venus? Well, in the year 2006, at the AAS Division for Planetary Sciences meeting, there was a presentation given by a couple of Caltech researchers named Alex Alemi and David Stevenson called Why Venus Has No Moon. Now, given our best theories about how the early solar system forms, it's pretty likely that most inner planets, planets like Earth and like Venus, would undergo heavy bombardment in their early years, including at least one large collision at some point. Now, like we already talked about, a large collision between Earth and a Mars-sized object probably created our moon. And in this study, the authors argue that the same type of catastrophic impact happened to Venus at least twice. So according to their model, the sequence goes like this. Venus suffers a massive collision early in formation, and the resulting debris in orbit around Venus becomes its first moon. Because of tidal interactions with Venus, this moon gains momentum over time and drifts farther and farther away from the planet. And actually, as a side note, the same thing is gradually happening to Earth's moon today, but at a very slow pace. So as the moon raises tides on Earth, the Earth contributes back to the moon's orbital energy, and the moon's orbit becomes wider and wider all the time. Alemi and Stevenson are proposing the same thing happened to Venus and its first moon that formed here. But then, according to their model, about 10 million years later or so, Venus gets hit by a giant impact again. The second impact happens at an angle and velocity that ends up reversing the planet's spin, and this would account for why Venus spins in the opposite direction from the other planets and why its rate of rotation is so sluggish. But now, because the planet is rotating in the opposite direction, tidal interactions drag on the moon rather than adding energy to its orbit, so the moon spirals in instead of spiraling out, and it ends up merging into Venus. And if there was another moon created by this second collision, it would have also fallen down and been absorbed into the planet as well. So again, this is just a model, just a hypothetical proposal, but if they are correct, Venus would have had at least one moon in the past, possibly multiple moons, but catastrophic impacts made it eat its own satellite.
The violent formation of a moon, and then the violent destruction of a moon as well.
One strange trivia fact I came across that I wanted to mention, one of the main writers who was an astronomer who dispelled with the notions of a satellite for Venus and explained them away in terms of various other possible explanations for the sightings, mm-hmm. was a guy named Maximilian Hell, also known as Father Hell.
Oh, wow. Yeah, any version of that name is cool. Maximilian Hell, Max Hell, Father Hell. Oh, man. Mr. Hell.
It's very good.
He will set you straight about the super hot, high pressure world.
All right. Well, that does it for me.
Yeah, I guess that about rounds it up. I mean, I think a sizable episode about the moons of two planets that have no moons. So I think it bodes well for the future when we move back to planets that actually have moons and discuss the details of those actual lunar bodies. So I look forward to it. And I guess one thing I would like to hear from everyone, like, where do you want us to go next? Do we just keep going in order? Do we look to Uranus and Neptune? Or do we just shoot straight to Pluto and go there? Or do we start looking at the dwarf planet? Yeah, other dwarf planets and their various moons. Let us know. There's also just the whole topic of talking about hypothetical moons and all is like the subject of exo moons of moons around exoplanets and what we expect to see and what we have seen or haven't seen in particular. This is an interesting topic as well. Or maybe you're sick of moons. I don't know. Let us know about that as well. We cover a kind of wide variety of topics here, and we know that some topics are not for all listeners. But that's just part of trying to cast a wide net and to stay curious about reality.
We promise here and now that we will never do an April Fool's Day episode where we report the existence of a spurious moon.
Yes, that's the stuff to blow your mind. Promise. All right, we're going to go ahead and close it up here then. But yeah, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you thought about this episode, possible future episodes, anything else. Just write in and let us know. In the meantime, you can find Stuff to Blow Your Mind wherever you get your podcasts. Just look for the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. You'll find core science and culture episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We have short form episodes on Mondays and Wednesdays. And on Fridays, we do Weird House Cinema. That's when we set the science aside and we talk about a weird movie for a little bit. Tune in. And if the platform gives you the ability to do so, just rate, review, and subscribe.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves, so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Tenor girl go shopping.
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.